Did you know that in 1975 there was a television drama called The 10th Level, starring William Shatner, based on the work of Dr. Stanley Milgram? We'll be back in a moment as we continue our discussion with Dr. Thomas Blass on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Blass, would you categorize the My Lai massacre, where 350 men, women, and children were killed by American soldiers during the Vietnam War, as part of this kind of obedience method as well?
I think there are similarities, yeah, which is why I think, yes, there were similarities. Here's a commander who is commanding his subordinates to kill civilians, just like that. And in fact, Milgram, in his book, draws a parallel between his work and that. And of course, there are certain things in the military that make it different from civilian life. On the other hand, military also has certain rules of what's legitimate and what's illegitimate. And there's no question that My Lai went beyond legitimacy and beyond human compassion. But talking about the military, actually, one of the current contemporary influences of Milgram's work, and there's a lot of it. I mean, we look at his work. His work has permeated contemporary culture and thought. One of the places where you see an influence is the military. Actually, a military psychologist named David Grossman, told me that when he was in officer training at West Point, this was in the early 70s. They showed him, as part of the training, they showed him training films on how to disobey illegitimate orders. Can you imagine disobey the army whose success really relies on obedience, a structure of obedience? Can you imagine teaching new soldiers how to disobey concretely? You know, if you go to your superior officer, he doesn't want to help you, go to the chaplain. If he doesn't want to do anything, go to the next one. And he attributes this to two things. Number one, to the My Lai tragedy, but number two, to Milgram's work. He said he called it a revolution in military history. So the military actually has taken Milgram's work to heart. Unfortunately, as we saw in Abu Ghraib, it didn't filter down to the lower level, personnel.
It proves that it still works, though, unfortunately.
Yeah. Right.
How did this affect his life and his career once he did this?
It had some major effects on him. First of all, obviously people held him to be, some people, you know, identified with what he did with who he was, just like his work was kind of, had a kind of mad genius quality to it, had a sinister quality to it. They attributed his work, you know, they've generalized to him, well, he must be a mad scientist. But after Yale, he was invited to go to Harvard. Harvard was for him academic Eden. That's where he got his PhD. He loved it, and they offered him a job position. He took it, even though he could have stayed on at Yale. There's a myth around that, you know, he got kicked out of Yale because of the obedience experiments. That never happened. He could have could have stayed there. Anyway, he went to Harvard, and Harvard actually turned him down for tenure. He went to he became totally depressed as a result of that. I mean, the epitome for him was Harvard. Harvard was an academic Eden. One of his colleagues called it, he had a bad, fatal case of Harvarditis, which means that not only is Harvard the best school in the world, it's the only school in the world. And when he got turned down, it was just devastating for him personally. So after that, the further disappointment was that he was hoping if he had to leave Harvard, he would get, you know, offers from Berkeley, from Stanford, from, you know, the top schools, Columbia, but none of them came knocking. And the reason very simple, because by that time he was so controversial that there was no way that any decent department was going to get a unanimous vote or even a majority vote on his acceptability. So also earlier on, the APA actually withheld withheld his application for membership. This was even before he published any stuff, but word got around that he was doing these experiments. Somebody actually at Yale snitched, if you will, to APA, and they held up his membership until they could conduct an investigation. They gave him a clean bill of health. But the main thing was he did not get to stay at Harvard, which he loved, and then he didn't get any great offers. He did get a very good offer, objectively speaking, at the City University of New York Graduate Center, which was starting a new program in social psychology, PhD program, and he was offered the chairmanship. So any outsider looking at that would say, hey, this was a plum. His job, first of all, he went from assistant professor to full professor, skipping the associate professor level, triple salary. He had he could run the program. He could put his imprint on the program, which he did. By that time, he started getting interested in urban psychology. And yet, he couldn't see himself staying for more than 5 years. It just wasn't the prestige, you know. It didn't have the prestige of a Columbia.
Right.
But it turned out to be, actually, this way he stayed to the rest of his life until he died at, age, as you mentioned earlier, age of 51. It turned out much, much better than he expected. In some ways, it was his most productive part of his career. He was there from 69 to 84. And although none of what he did there matched the obedience experiments and their importance, overall importance, much of the stuff that he did was fascinating and inventive. For example, he did an innovative study on the effect of media violence and antisocial behavior, which has never been duplicated. That is in its sophistication. He got the cooperation of CBS to film segments of an ongoing program called Medical Center to fit the needs of the experiment. In other words, they had actually three different endings. Of the same, 95% of this segment was the same. The last 5 minutes were different. So the two versions, there was an antisocial act. The main character is stealing money from charity boxes scattered throughout town.
All right.
And then viewers who get to see this are given an opportunity, sort of unobtrusively, to actually also steal money from a similar situation. And they were observed by hidden cameras. So the point is, although the findings were inconclusive, it still remains unique in the sense that he was able to get a major network to produce material, stimulus materials, to fit exactly the needs of his experiment. This has never been duplicated, and still remains unique in that regard. He did work on something called mental maps, subjective maps of New York, subjective maps of Paris. How does the individual see his surroundings, and how does that affect his behavior? He did lightweight stuff, but he was driven as much by curiosity as by the ultimate importance of the work was, or what other people thought was important. For example, he studied subway behavior. One day, his mother-in-law comes to visit them. They lived in Riverdale. She lived on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. She says, "Why is it?" She was in her 70s. She says, "Why is it that people no longer give up their seats for gray-haired ladies?" So Milgram looks at her and he says, "Well, did you ask anybody?" Well, she thought he was out of his mind.
Sure.
You asked somebody in New York to give up their seat in the subway? So next day, this was the next class day, he goes into class. He says, "Boys and girls, we're going to go down into the subways of New York." And what he did was he had his students go up to seated passengers and simply ask them, "Excuse me, can I have your seat?" Okay, so if you ask people to predict how many people would get up in New York City, right, and give up their seat, their hard-won seat, right? Well, it turned out, you know, most estimates would say maybe zero, one, you know, two. In actuality, over.
See, and I would have said it's probably based on who's asking.
That is true, but all of them were kind of, you know, healthy-looking graduate students.
Yeah.
And yet over 50%. Got up and gave up their seat. And what was surprising is not so much here. The stress was not the subject, that is the person who gave up their seat. The stress actually was experienced by the requester, by the students, because when they sat down, they felt sick. Because how else do you justify asking an older passenger to give up his or her seat unless you must really need it? And many said this was one of the most difficult things they had to do, to make that request. And when you think about it, it's just a very simple thing, but it illustrates a broader point, which really permeates much of Milgram's work. The power of norms, that is, we are Much of our social behavior is guided by unwritten rules of what is appropriate, what is inappropriate behavior. There's an unwritten rule in the subways, on the trains, that, you know, first come, first serve. It's almost like your territory.
Yeah.
You just don't go up to somebody and ask them for their seat. And violating this norm was just painful, you know, to do. And once they got their seat, they had to justify to themselves by actually feeling sick, literally. So, you know, on one hand, it's a very simple study, but on the other hand, it first was counterintuitive. Nobody would have predicted it. And secondly, it touches on the broader issue of these silent systems of these unverbalized rules that bind us, that determine our behavior and their power.
It sounds like he loved getting into people's minds.
Well, I'm not sure in what sense you mean that.
Well, in terms of his experiments, I think he really enjoyed trying to come up with experiments that would prove his own thinking on how people would react.
Right, and also, he was curious, and he certainly delighted in coming up with with findings that people would not predict. There's no question about it. But he was a hands-on person. You know, he liked to do things. He was not much of a theoretician. He was brilliant. He was genius. People considered him to be a genius. But he was interested in phenomena. For example, there's something called the 6 degrees of separation, which actually originally...
Now what is that?
Well, what that is actually the original name for that was called the small world problem. This was when he was still at Harvard, actually. A mathematician and political scientist came up with a mathematical model predicting that if you take a huge social network, you know, hundreds, millions of people, thousands of people, you can actually create a direct connection, a much more direct connection between two strangers within that social network. A surprisingly small number of links, it would only take a small number of links to connect any two strangers. They worked this out mathematically. Well, Milgram wanted to see whether it actually works in real life. So what he did was he set up an experiment where so-called starters, let's say in Nebraska, were given letters, and they were told, well, you have to get this letter to this stockbroker in Sharon, Massachusetts. And the way to do it is you have to pass it on to somebody whom you know on a first-name basis, who then has to pass it on to somebody who he knows on a first-name basis, and so on, until the target person is reached. Now, again, if you would ask people, and he did, how many intermediate links of acquaintances would it take to reach the target person, people predicted maybe 50, 40. When actually it turned out to be, on the average, it only took about 6 links of acquaintances to connect two strangers.
And that's it? That's amazing.
Yeah. Now, I should add that not all the chains were completed, but those that were completed, it only took 6 links. And it entered contemporary culture via a play called 6 Degrees of Separation, and then a movie. And today, that phenomenon is more known by that name than the small world problem. But again, here we have a person, he hears a theoretical idea, but he wants to see whether it actually works in real life and goes out and tests it. And actually, it turns out he discovered something much more than he thought he did, because today, last few years, a number of people in the areas of physical science, applied mathematicians, have shown that the small world principle, the idea that you can connect points in a large network, not only social networks, but physical networks, with a very kind of cut a swath of a small number of links connecting points in a very large network, that applies even in the social realm. So that apparently, you know, for example, the grids in the Western United States, electric grids, conform to the small world principle. The cells of an amoeba, the connections between cells and an amoeba, conform to the small world principle. The people who did this, Strogatz and Watts at Cornell University. So the small world principle that Milgram discovered actually accounts for much more than he thought it did. He only thought it accounted for social networks, but it seems to be broader. There's also stuff that he did. He identified a creature of urban life called the familiar stranger. Familiar stranger is basically a term he gave to people that, let's suppose you take a commuter train into from your suburb into the main part of town every day, and you see the same passengers, you know, same time, same station.
Mm-hmm. But you don't know them.
No, you don't talk to them. You never talk to them. Familiar strangers, familiar, but you never talk to them. So he wanted to find out, you know, whether to what extent does this exist. So he actually did a study where he had his students take photographs of commuters waiting at the station, happens to be his station, and then asked them to identify which people they knew but didn't speak to. And it turned out everybody knew at least one familiar stranger. Most, the average was four. Now, when you think of this, actually he describes this in a very powerful, evocative description of this. He provides in a film, one of his films called "The City and the Self."
So he did a lot of films, didn't he?
He did. But this particular study actually was very. How should I put it? It actually predicted in some way future events. It was very much evocative of and powerful in light of September 11, 2001, 9/11, because if you just give me a moment, he actually hears his voiceover, which captures the power of this.
Sure.
What he found, he said, "We studied the familiar strangers. We spoke to them in station after station, and this is what they told us. As the years go by, familiar strangers become harder to talk to. The barrier hardens, and we know. If we were to meet one of these strangers far from the station, say when we were abroad, we would stop, shake hands, and acknowledge for the first time that we know each other, but not here. And we know if there was a great calamity, a flood, a fire, a storm, the barriers would crumble. We would talk to each other. But the problem for those of us who live in the city is this. How can we come closer without the fire, without the flood, without the storm?" And when you think about this and what happened, this, he wrote this in 1972, and how true this was during 9/11 when people did become closer, but it took that fire, it took that, you know, the catastrophe, that took that horrendous, event to bring people closer together. Here it is in this almost a kind of a lyrical poem that he wrote in 1972. Describing the familiar stranger. So, yeah, he made films, and that was another part of it. Milgram was actually a Nero. He considers himself a neo-Renaissance man.
You know, could use that same analogy, too, though, in an elevator. How many times do you go into an elevator every day and maybe see the same people? Exactly. Not a lot of people talk to each other in an elevator.
Exactly, Thomas. Exactly. But yet they're familiar. Exactly. We have this norm of ignoring each other. You know, that's, except, I mean, you might say, hey, you know, it's great. The weather is out. You know, it's nice out today. I wonder what it's like going to be tomorrow. It's kind of non-talk. It's like machine talk, you know. But you're right. We ignore each other. That's the norm. On a larger scale, you know, in the city, it has broader. Yeah, that's a specific form of it. No question about it. But he made films, and some of them were award-winning ones. The one I just read the voiceover from was called "The City and the Self," which was an award-winning film showing how the city people change, people's behavior change in the urban environment as a way of adapting to what he called stimulus overload. In other words, in the city, we're bombarded by more stimuli than the system than we can absorb. So we have to develop behavioral tactics to deal with that, and that's how. People, for example, are in general less helpful in the city than in smaller towns, one of the standard findings in the literature.
He's a genius.
He was a genius. And as far as he was a genius, he was a quirky genius. And by that I mean he did things that people couldn't figure out why he did what he did. I had one of his students say that the students would talk about Milgram's wonders as in, "I wonder why he did that." You know, for example, one of his students, John Sabini, had a 10 o'clock appointment with him one morning. He shows up 1 minute to 10 and comes into the door and says, "Milgram says, go out and wait another minute." So he goes out, sits down on the bench, waits a minute. Meanwhile, Milgram has his feet propped up on his desk. And then finally, 10 o'clock arrives, he lets him in. Another day he came.
Hold that thought, Thomas. We'll be right back.
Well, producer Tom has informed me that while I've been in St. Louis, my plant Bertha is dying in my office. Bertha has been with me since I moved to Los Angeles in 2003. This is not good news. It was his job. It was his responsibility to water Bertha, and he apparently has failed. All her leaves, he tells me, are brown, and she's withered, and it could be the end for Bertha. And it may end up being the end for Tommy, quite frankly. Back in a moment. Thomas, tell me a little bit about the Milgram lost letter technique. What was that?
Sure. The lost letter technique was a way of assessing community attitudes toward issues. As you know, a common problem in, you know, doing interview polling, opinion polling, is the so-called interviewer effect. Sometimes, either on the phone or face-to-face, the respondent might give you the answers that he thinks you want to hear, you know, just to please you or not to make waves or what have you. Well, with the lost letter technique, Milgram came up with a way of eliminating that problem. What he did was he distributed letters in one of the first studies. He distributed letters addressed to, one was addressed to friends of Nazi Party, another friends of the Communist Party, another one to medical research associates, another one to a private individual, and had them distributed, student distributed all over New Haven on the streets and phone booths and so on, and wait about 3 weeks. They all had the same incoming P.O. box address, and waited to see how many were actually mailed. Well, as you might predict, well, essentially the person finding it is, in a, for example, suppose I find a letter addressed to friends of the Nazi Party, I'm in a state of conflict. On the one hand, I know the right thing to do, you know, is to mail the letter. I would want that done to me if I lose the letter. On the other hand, if I mail the letter, I'm in some way presumably helping the goals of an organization I detest. So, but at the end of 3 weeks, the pattern of incoming returned letters corresponded to what might expect. In other words, 75% of the medical research associates, the fictitious but laudable group, the private individual, 75 out of 100 came in, but the friends of the Communist Party, friends of the Nazi Party, only about 20, 25 were returned. So in other words, this was sort of a first run, a test of the validity of the idea. And the advantage here is that you're getting genuine, rather than, you know, self-report attitudes, written statements about how you feel. Your feelings are expressed through action. Your attitudes toward the Nazi Party are expressed through action, or non-action in this case. That was one of his inventive things. But if you just, we were in the midst of, just want to mention a little bit more about this. We'd like to hear a bit some more about his personality.
Mm-hmm. Hmm? Yeah.
He was a complex individual. We were talking about his wonders, the quirkiness, but that's pretty much the, as far as the lost letter technique, it was a, in fact, he used it later on to predict the Goldwater Johnson contest, which was not a difficult prediction, but actually he did predict the outcome about 2 months beforehand by distributing letters throughout the Boston area. At one point, he tried dropping letters from a plane, but that got a little too dangerous. The letters got caught in the propeller. But, so I had to use more pedestrian means. But just to return to his personality for a moment, you asked me about his personality. I mean, he was very complex, a complex individual, and that was one of the challenges of writing this book, to capture that complexity. When I talk to students, his friends, people either loved him or hated him. I mean, basically, he was the most popular mentor, PhD student mentor at CUNY. He would do anything for students that he liked. I saw in the archives when I did research that the day before he died, he was sending out 3 letters of recommendation for a student who had graduated, got his PhD six years earlier. There was a story of where a student, a disgruntled student, had an interview with Milgram in his office. When he left, Milgram noticed there was a hole dug in his leather couch. Apparently, the student, expressing in hidden manner his animosity toward Milgram, sort of got even. But I think the overriding I think the outstanding, in my judgment, personal quality was a sense of humor. I mean, it got expressed in many, many different ways. He just, it's almost as if it was an irrepressible quality, an irrepressible sense of humor, and he used it in different ways. Let me just give you two or three examples. As he got famous, he got a lot of letters from people. One day he gets a letter from a young mother saying that her son James is celebrating his first birthday, and what she wants to do is give him autographs from a selected group of world leaders in science and arts and so on. And she asked, would he send an autographed photograph of himself, to commemorate the kid's birthday?
Sure.
So he does that, and he writes as follows. He's, Dear James, he's writing to the kid, mind you. Do you agree with the analysis of child disobedience discussed on page 208 of my book, Obedience to Authority? You will soon be in a position to know about such things and instruct your parents. He also used his humor sort of as a weapon, deadly weapon, in scholarly combat. He had one critic. He had many criticisms of his work. Aside from the ethics, some people questioned the genuineness of the finding. One critic named Oren argued, he says, you know why people went along at such a high rate? Because they actually quickly saw through the deception. You know, the contrast between this calm experimenter, cool as a cucumber, saying, please go on, and the learner pitifully crying, the incongruity leads people to discover, hey, things are not what they seem, and they realize that the whole thing is a phony setup. Well, then the question is, if it's a phony setup, why don't they just get up and leave? Well, Oren argued because people didn't want to ruin the experiment. So Milgram, there was an exchange, a written exchange between them. Milgram writes to Oren as follows. Oren's suggestion that the subjects only feigned sweating, trembling, and stuttering to please the experimenter is pathetically detached from reality, equivalent to the statement that hemophiliacs bleed to keep their physicians happy. So you get the sarcasm there, but to make a point. But finally, just give you a final example. You know, he died from heart trouble in 1951.
Would he have a heart attack?
He had a heart attack. Yeah, he had serious heart attacks and heart failure. His heart just simply failed and died in the emergency room in Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in December of 1984. So he's lying in the emergency room, and as his life is ebbing away, he asks his cardiologist, do you happen to have any baboon hearts available? And he was referring to, actually, his humor was still there. He was referring to, there was a case of baby Faye at the same time in which a baby was given a baboon's heart and she survived.
Right, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and so he's asking him, you know, I mean, obviously that, you know, it was, you know, his irrepressible humor to the very, very end. And that's just the way he was. So he was a complex individual, person of contrasts, and very talented, very quirky, a quirky genius.
What have we learned from his experiments, Thomas, specifically how we as individuals can fight or defend ourselves against, you know, unbelievable orders that we don't want or pressures from people, things that are unwanted that we don't want anything to do with?
Well, I think the number of steps that one can take that we can derive directly or indirectly from Milgram's work. First of all, if somebody tells you to do something that you don't want to do, that you feel is wrong, the first thing is to question the authority's legitimacy. Remember, Milgram argued that once the first step is to accept, if you feel the authority is legitimate, that is, he has a right to tell you what to do, then everything else follows. You will act in ways that you normally don't act. Well, to stop something that's reprehensible is to ask what right you have to tell me to do this. The problem is we give too wide a berth to people who project a commanding presence. And one study, for example, found that this was an experiment. People went up to pedestrians on a sidewalk and said, see that guy over there? He needs a coin to feed the meter. And the passerby was asked either by a person dressed in a uniform or just dressed in a suit, or just sloppy jeans. Well, the person dressed in an ambiguous uniform, it could have been like the doorman, it wasn't a policeman, it was ambiguous, actually elicited a higher number of people complying with the command, if you will, to give this guy a dime than when he was dressed in ways that that conveyed less authority. So the first thing is the question, does this person have a right to tell me what to do? Does his authority apply in this context? Well, if the answer is no, that stops things right there. Another tactic one can use to defend against unwanted pressure is to stop to ask yourself, is this something I would do on my own initiative? Because we do, one of the troubling parts of what Milgram found is that under orders, we do things that we don't would not do on my own initiative. So if you're confronted with an unpleasant and despicable request, you ask yourself, is this something I would do on my own initiative? The answer is no. That means it's time to stop. And furthermore, another thing what one can draw from Milgram is actually don't even start to comply with commands that you feel slightly uneasy about. Because one of the things that we learn from the Milgram experiments is that to acquiesce to commands which are only mildly objectionable, often, like in his experiments, is just the beginning of an escalating process of entrapment, where one step at a time you get deeper and deeper into the muck. And in fact, it becomes more difficult to pry yourself away the further along you are in the continuum. Because to pull away at, let's say, 330 volts, is to tell yourself, well, up to this point, all I did was wrong, and you can't, you know, that's kind of very dissonant. So the point is, if even something that you're slightly uncomfortable about, don't start it, because it's likely to get worse, and it becomes even more difficult to pry yourself away when it does get worse. And I guess maybe one other thing one can draw from him is that if you're in a situation where you're given immoral orders, the thing to do is, especially in an organizational setting, try to find an ally who can see, who shares your perceptions about the wrongfulness of the orders, mm-hmm. Who's willing to join you in opposing the objectionable commands. Because it's tremendously difficult to be a lone dissenter, and of course that's why we admire whistleblowers. I mean, because they go against
the grain, exactly.
They go against a very strong bloc. But it's just as an aside, I just came across a very interesting finding about demonstrating how difficult it is to be a lone dissenter. Somebody did a very clever archival study named Granberg. It appeared in the journals a few months ago. What he did was he analyzed Supreme Court decisions over the last 50 years, and he found that the least frequent pattern of the judges, was an 8-to-1 split. The least frequent judgment configuration was an 8-to-1 split. In other words, only 10% of the time was the Supreme Court judgment in a particular case. And 10% of the time did it take an 8-to-1 split. So, in other words, here's one person obviously being pitted against the majority, which even people of high stature, we would assume, would not be bothered by that, but even they were bothered by it. But anyway, the point is to get allies, which is sometimes easier said than done. But ultimately, if somebody can, as other people see the world as you can, you're not the lone dissenter, which is very difficult to be. Actually, Milgram did an experiment which demonstrated this very concretely. He had one setup where he, instead of having one teacher, he was part of a team of three teachers. The two others were Confederates. Okay, so you have three people are involved in trying to teach this learner, the Confederate, the word list, the word pairs.
Yes.
But what happens is that only one is the real subject. The other two are Confederates. And each in turn drops off. And one at 150 volts, he says, I'm not going any further. The second one at 210 volts, I'm not going to go any further. The question is, now, what happens to the remaining teacher, the real subject? Well, what happens is that in this experiment, only 10% of the subjects were fully obedient. That is, once they had allies, in a sense, once they saw the example set by defiant peers, it liberated his own ability to be defiant. So he was no longer the lone dissenter. The point is to get it, whatever possible, allies are very important, because it is very difficult to be the lone person who stands up against a wall of opposition.
Is anybody conducting similar experiments today, like he did with his voltage on people?
Not really, because it would be impossible. Well, at least in theory, it probably could be done. In practice, it's virtually impossible because of the regulations, human research regulations we have in place today. Because the centerpiece of requirements, government requirements, is the notion of informed consent. And it would be virtually impossible to do a Milgram experiment if people knew what they were getting into. Right, because if you knew that your obedience was being studied, mm-hmm. the results would not be valid. So it'd be very, very hard to do. Plus, of course, the stress involved. But what you do have actually is real life analogs. You don't actually do it in a laboratory, but you have real life analogs, which are essentially Milgram experiments in vivo. For example, you probably have read about these atrocious strip searches. In which the situation is more or less like this. A person gets a call, like in a McDonald's or Wendy's, a manager, and a person on the line claims to be a policeman. He says, "See that girl in the corner, the blonde, the short blonde? Well, she stole some money. I want you to take her in the next room and do a strip search on her." Well, you figure most people would say goodbye and good luck and hang up on him.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's not what happened. Across a period of 10 years, beginning in 1995, there were 70 instances where it turned out to be the same person who was finally caught, pretending to be a policeman, tells a manager or some person in this little fast food restaurant to carry out sexually abusive, perverse acts, in many cases, on an employee. Sometimes it's a customer. And in 70 instances, ranging all the way from Alaska down to Florida, Kentucky, all over the country, almost every state, not every state, but almost
one,
every state.
One guy was doing this?
Yeah, yeah. And he was so convincing that people believed that he was a policeman.
Was he there? Because how did he know?
No. Well, he was actually very astute. He was able to get information. He was, you could find out who the manager is. You can.
So, so he studied places before
exactly,
he acted.
Exactly. Yeah. And the point is, he must have been so convincing. I wish I had a recording of his voice, because he's going to be. There's a trial. I don't know if it took place yet, but anyway. But can you imagine 70 cases across a 10-year period of a person pretending to be a policeman, getting people to carry out acts which were despicable, lewd acts, acts involving humiliation. In one case, the strip search was much pretty much standard. In one case, the person was ordered to slap this girl, have her dance up and down naked to help the money kind of drop out.
And I assume, Thomas, that he had the manager come back on the line after he did this deed to tell this guy so he could get his jollies, right?
Well, he was instructing the manager constantly. That is, the manager was the one that's carrying out this act.
Yeah, but I mean, I bet the manager then came back on the phone after
right.
the
well,
search.
Not only that, sometimes he would be on the phone continuously.
With the guy was doing this?
Monitoring.
Unbelievable.
Telling him what to do, yeah.
I mean, were these managers stupid?
Well, you know, that's one argument one can make. In some ways, they didn't see the boundaries. I guess you could say they were stupid, because, you know, what does it mean to what does slapping a kid on the behind have to do with searching, finding out if she stole anything? And people just kind of suspended critical judgment. They put their critical judgment on ice. And yes, stupid, but they claimed that they believed that this was a policeman. But what they didn't recognize is that even a policeman, that people have domains of authority that are limited. And to carry out acts which have absolutely nothing to do with what they were accused of stealing money, and continue to carry them out. And in some case, there were, as I say, sexually abusive acts involved, perverse acts.
But a guy with a brain, Thomas, would have said, first of all, officer, you're going to need to come here and identify yourself.
Right.
And I'm not going to conduct it because it's against our company policy. You're going to need to do that.
Right.
And things like that. I mean, they were hiring people, obviously, with no brains.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is, some people, in fact, did hang up on them. That we don't know how many. Obviously, some people did.
Yeah, if 70 were successful, maybe he made 10,000 calls. Who knows? Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. Let's open up your phone lines for this very strange series of events on Coast to Coast AM.